This is Dwight Holloway, sitting in for Garth R. Anseer, inviting you to focus on youth. This week with retired Admiral Elmo Zumwalt.
Focus on Youth, America's student-produced press conference of the air, is made possible by funding from the Shell Oil Company.
From 1970 to 1974, Admiral Zumwalt was the Chief of Naval Operations, or the Principal Naval Advisor to the President and the Congress. During his tenure as the Navy's top man, he took major steps to prevent the Soviet Union from gaining superiority in the SALT I Accord. Furthermore, he fought hard to improve the life of the average sailor. Currently the president of American Medical Buildings Association, Admiral Zumwalt continues to speak out against the growing Soviet military threat to the Western world. Our first question is from Mitch Simmel.
Admiral, a number of people since the end of World War II have questioned the effectiveness and indeed the role of the Navy in the missile age. And I'm just curious as to your particular perceptions of the effectiveness of the structuring of a Navy when you have, for example, increasing missile technology so that, in many ways, ships that were once effective in conventional warfare could, in fact, be knocked out by some of the more sophisticated weapons.
Well, one has to ask, what is it to that is being discussed? In a strategic nuclear war, any target that gets hit is destroyed, whether it's the city of Washington or an Air Force base or a ship. When those missiles begin to fly, I'd rather be on a moving target than a fixed target. Every fixed target of importance will be destroyed. Some moving targets will survive. In a conventional war, ships are simply mandatory. There's no way to keep the sea lines open without ships to do so.
Sir, there's a growing disparity between the number of ships in the United States fleet and the number of ships in the Soviet fleet. Current estimates show that the United States has approximately half the number of ships in the Soviet fleet. Furthermore, slashes in President Carter's budget for shipbuilding promised to magnify the mounting advantage of the Soviet Navy. At stake is national security and the United States Navy's control of the seas. Can the United States presently thwart a Soviet attack? And what will happen to the balance of power if this trend continues?
At the present time, the United States Navy has only about one quarter of the number of ships that the Soviet Union has. The odds are that the United States Navy would lose a war with the Soviet Union today. The odds dropped below 50%. In 1971, I testified both before the Congress and informed President Nixon. Each year of decelerating odds, by the time I left office, we had about a 35% probability of victory.
You've met Mitch Simmel. Also on this week's student panel is Alexander Kenyon. Our guest is retired Admiral Elmo Zumwalt, and I'm Dwight Holloway. We continue now with a question from Alexander Kenyon.
Admiral, in a recent Saturday Evening Post article, you suggest the striking of a compromise somewhere between the anti-communist mania of the 1950s and what seems to be the dovish, don't care, we're superior attitude of the 1970s. I wonder, how could that balance be struck now? And also, in a related question, whether you felt that the armed services, and the Navy in particular, have to bear some of the responsibility for the people's attitude in the first place. Do you in fact agree that the military's aggressiveness in the 60s does not sit well here in the 1970s?
No, I very much disagree that the armed services should be held responsible. The decision to get involved in Vietnam was a presidential decision recommended by a civilian Secretary of Defense over and against the advice of many senior military. I, for one, fought very hard against getting involved in South Vietnam back in 1963 and 64. With regard to how one strikes a sensible compromise between the two extremes that I discussed, I think it takes the kind of effort that we're engaged in here today on the broadest possible basis. Lots and lots of discussion of the dramatic way in which the Soviet Union is using its overwhelming strategic nuclear superiority and its present conventional military superiority to force the West to accommodate to Soviet invasions using Cuban troops and Soviet equipment in Hannibal-like expeditions around the continent of Africa and elsewhere.
Stay tuned. Focus on Youth continues in a moment.
Here's another safe driving tip from Shell. When you're turning left in a busy intersection, don't turn your wheels before you start to make your move. Why? Because if you're struck from the rear while your wheels are turned left, you'll be knocked into the path of oncoming traffic. Leaving your wheels straight is an important defensive driving technique. Learn more safe driving tips in the Driving Skills book, free at participating Shell dealers.
Come to Shell for answers.
You're sending a letter cross country, or maybe it's just across town. Well, if you slip and forget the right zip, you just might slow it down. So check your address, is everything there? Make sure there's nothing you skip. Whether it's going near or far, zip up your mail with the right zip.
Good news travels better in a letter with the right zip. Good news travels better in a letter with the right zip.
Five little numbers, that's nothing. You can do that easily. And when you use the right zip code, the mail moves efficiently. A note or a very long letter to help speed it well on its way. Make sure you use the right zip code, cause you don't want to delay.
Good news travels better in a letter with the right zip.
Yes, it does.
Good news travels better in a letter with the right zip.
Welcome back to Focus on Youth. Our guest is Admiral Elmo Zumwalt. We continue with a question from Alexander Kenyon.
Many people, particularly liberal publications such as The Nation, along with books such as David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest, have suggested the opposite of what you said, that although many people like yourself objected to continued involvement, there was military pressure to do so from other quarters. The Soviets certainly have their right-wing military people who want to become more involved in those sideshow conflicts such as Vietnam. Would you deny that this, in fact, existed in the United States?
In my experience, the tendency on the part of the liberal representatives of the media is to set up that fiction as a straw man. I have never found that cabal of right-wing military seeking to get the United States involved in anything. I have found that the military consider themselves exactly what they are supposed to be, the servants of the civilian authority, and that the debates that take place as to whether or not to get involved in this or that action are almost exclusively the purview of civilian authority.
Mitch Semmel.
In a related question, a number of journalists who were writing during the early 60s and then again in the later 60s with retrospect to what happened in the early years of Vietnam has said that a certain mindset developed within the armed services, which said that in order for one to advance, one had to be sending in more and more optimistic reports, even as the situation within Vietnam was getting worse and worse. I'd like to know really two things. First, if you feel that was true with regard to Navy intelligence that was sent from Saigon to the United States. And second, whether you think that if that's true, that a mindset similar to that exists within the armed services today.
I served in Vietnam from September of 1968 until May of 1970, just before becoming Chief of Naval Operations. My immediate superior in command was General Creighton Abrams, who was the theater commander. General Abrams' policy was one of absolute and meticulous conformance to the facts. He would not tolerate the slightest inference or adjective connotating anything different than what the facts were. I cannot answer for earlier periods, but I will flatly assert that there was never any attempt made to distort the true facts. During the 20 months that I served in Vietnam, 1968 to 1970, there simply was nothing other than a meticulous official policy to report only the facts.
Sir, you've constantly criticized Henry Kissinger for contracting the United States to the SALT I Accord. What are the disadvantages of this agreement?
The SALT I Accord was a disastrously, ambiguously worded agreement, which had loopholes in it so wide that the Russians have been able to drive their violating trucks through it. The SALT I agreement permitted the Soviet Union, during the period it was in existence, to achieve strategic nuclear superiority. The prospective SALT II agreement will deny the United States any right to recover strategic nuclear equality.
How have the Soviets specifically broken the SALT I Accord?
They have violated the agreements as they were explained by the administration to the U.S. Congress in some seven or eight different ways. They have interfered with our means of national detection, which is a violation of both the treaty and the interim executive agreement. They have conducted a large series of tests of surface-to-air missiles in the anti-ballistic missile mode in violation of the agreements. They have created missiles larger than the ones that we said we expected to be the upper limit, and they have produced mobile anti-ballistic missile radar systems in violation of the agreement.
Mitch Semmel?
Sir, have there been any similar violations on the part of the United States that you know of?
The Soviets assert one or two. They have been of a very minor nature. For example, on one occasion there was a cover over a Minuteman silo due to some repairs, and in order to eliminate any concern over that, the United States removed it. But the Soviet violations have been gross and have resulted in their achievement of strategic nuclear superiority today.
With certain events involving the Soviets and the Cubans in the different countries of Africa right now, it seems that, as many people say, the Soviets are testing us around the globe with small conventional land warfare. And I wonder if it's possible, given the role that the Nixon and Ford administrations have played in detente in the last few years, if it's possible for the United States now to take a hardline stance and extract some significant concessions from the Soviets during the furthering of the SALT talks.
Well, you see, the trouble with detente is that it has been misrepresented to the American people. We were taught to expect it to be something reasonable, a process of mutual adjustment between the superpowers. The Soviets have made it clear they never intended it to be that. They intend it to be the process of continuing unilateral accommodation by the United States to Soviet foreign policy. And they are achieving this, they tell us, and tell their people, by the achievement of overwhelming military superiority and the use of that as an umbrella to force us to accommodate to their foreign policy initiatives. This is why they believe they are able now to mount expedition after expedition, invading one territory after another in Africa, and to force the West to accept it.
Alexander Kenyon.
Admiral, have the Russians made any concessions in these talks whatsoever?
Yes, the Russians have moved about 1/16th of the distance between the U.S. and the Soviet positions, and the U.S. has moved 15/16th of the distance, as a result of which the Soviets have been given permanent strategic nuclear superiority as a right under the new SALT II deal, and we will forego in perpetuity any right to recover it.
More with our guest when Focus on Youth continues in a moment.
It shouldn't hurt to be a child, but sometimes the way we treat our children hurts. What can we do to stop the hurt?
I'll show my child some love.
And understanding.
I'll talk to a troubled parent.
And treat my child as a person.
And I want to love.
I
want
to love.
Not hurt.
Write Prevent Child Abuse, Box 2866, Chicago, Illinois, 60690, and stop the hurt. A public service message of this station, the Advertising Council, and the National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse.
This is the Focus on Youth Radio Network. For a cassette tape copy of today's Focus on Youth interview, send $5 in check or money order to Focus on Youth, Box 6460, Lawrenceville, New Jersey, 08648. That's $5 in check or money order to Focus on Youth, Box 6460, Lawrenceville, New Jersey, 08648.
Welcome back to Focus on Youth. Our guest is retired Admiral Elmo Zumwalt.
Sir, you've stated and demonstrated on many occasions that you don't trust the Soviet Union. Senator Scoop Jackson has stated that he trusts the Soviets as far as he can throw a grand piano. Although you might not be as generous in your estimation of the degree to which the Soviet Union can be trusted, how much can we trust the Chinese?
The Chinese are a communist leadership, and therefore ruthless, and will do whatever it takes to enhance their national power. The facts of the matter are that they are in such deep trouble economically, and they face such a fearsome military threat from the Soviet Union across their border with 50 divisions facing them, and they are so deeply concerned about that threat that the Chinese intend, in my judgment, to work very closely with us, practically as a de facto ally for the next 10 or 15 years. I had long talks with their senior vice premier and their foreign minister last July in China, and it's quite clear that they view the Soviets as the primary threat, and they view U.S. leadership as what they described as Chamberlain-like and appeasers.
Do you think that we ought to encourage the de facto alliance, as you put it, that they desire?
Yes, I think that we need to do everything we can to work as in a de facto relationship with the Chinese in those areas where it is to our mutual benefit. I believe we must constantly keep in mind that when the Chinese become sufficiently powerful that they no longer fear the Soviet Union, then they will be every bit as likely to try to do us in as is the Soviet leadership today.
Speaking with us a number of weeks ago, syndicated columnist William F. Buckley Jr. quoted Groucho Marx's comment that, "I wouldn't want to join any club so indiscreet as to have me as a member," in speaking of the Chinese view of the United States. His point was that while the Chinese constantly pressure us to break ties with the nationalists on Taiwan, they really don't want an ally that would show its weakness by breaking out of a 30-year alliance. Do you think that that's a fair assessment?
I do. I came back and reported to U.S. leadership, based on my talks, that it was quite clear the Chinese leaders, when they talked about severing our relationship with Taiwan, were being completely pro forma and for the record, whereas when they talked about the Soviet threat, they were scared right down to their gizzard.
Alexander Kenyon?
In other words, they do not see our giving up of Taiwan as a prerequisite to continued meaningful communication.
Quite the contrary, I think if we did so, as William Buckley has suggested, they would become contemptuous of us.
Sir, you were stationed in China, I believe, right out of Annapolis. Is that not correct?
No, I fought in World War II for 3 years, but took the first U.S. flag up the river to Shanghai at the end of the war.
And in the light of that experience, has the condition of the Chinese people changed in the time since then?
Yes, it has. In those days, people were starving to death and lying dead in the streets every morning, and that is under control. The price was 15 million dead Chinese slaughtered by the communist regime when they took over. To create that kind of discipline, they made much of the progress toward reducing the starvation of their people prior to the takeover of the communist regime, and one has to compare not now with 1945, but now with what might have been had another alternative regime remained in power.
Mitch Sommel?
I'd like to refer back to the SALT talks we were discussing previously. You have stated very eloquently on a number of occasions in articles and speeches your belief that the Soviet Union is not unprepared to fight a nuclear war, that as they see the possibility of winning such a war increasing, they will pressure the United States across the globe. Does your argument for a harder line stance against the Soviet Union preclude any kind of arms control?
No. Interestingly enough, what I have stated is what the Soviets are stating. Those who refuse to believe that the Soviets intend to have a strategic nuclear war-winning capability are those who just simply refuse to accept what the Soviet leaders are saying they intend to have.
If you were in the position of Paul Warnke, chief U.S. representative to the SALT talks, what specific policies would you pursue?
Well, if I were Paul Warnke, I would resign because I would have demonstrated that my conduct in office has been exactly the converse of what I testified in the confirmation hearings it was going to be, and exactly in conformance with what I had said before confirmation hearings my beliefs were. And I would therefore consider myself to be a discredited presidential appointee. If, on the other hand, I, Bud Zumwalt, were head of ACDA, I would be advocating that we not grant superiority to the Soviet Union, but insist on equality at reduced levels.
Alexander Kenyon?
I'd like to turn to Navy cost overruns for a minute. There has been a suit recently brought by some of the Navy's top defense contractors for $2.7 billion. Of course, the Navy and the American people have accused these companies of padding and underbidding. But I'd like to ask you, does the Navy, as some of these companies charge, bear any responsibility for these overruns or for these problems that have come about in America's shipyards?
Yes, the Navy does. Its primary responsibility is the result of the fact that Admiral Rickover is an individual who has achieved power greater than the ability of the Secretary of the Navy or the Secretary of Defense or even the President of the United States to contain, and has therefore been able to perturb budgets and create flawed programs and to get changes made in approved programs in such a way that they become more costly without monies having been appropriated, and this is responsible for a significant subset of the cost overruns to which you refer, not to all of them.
Sir, if you were a world leader and you had the option of selecting either the Soviet Navy or the United States Navy for selecting a Navy which had power, which Navy would you select?
I would be more comfortable in carrying out the job that Admiral Gorshkov, the head of the Soviet Navy for the last 20 years, has, than in carrying out the job that the chief of our Navy today has. Admiral Gorshkov's job is to cut the sea lines so that his country, which is basically a land power and can survive in wartime without the use of the seas, overrunning both Western Europe and China over landlines of communication, and causing his country to be only without the fish of the fishing fleets, that's a much easier job than is the job of the American Chief of Navy, who must keep those sea lines open in order, as a world island, to be able to reinforce overseas allies or even to retreat and just concentrate on bringing in oil and resources into this country.
You've been involved in the debate between nuclear power versus conventional power, and I was wondering if you felt that we should go for a greater amount of modest vessels versus a few highly sophisticated nuclear ships.
The problem is that we need a mix, and that we are constantly being driven by Admiral Rickover's nuclear lobby toward only nuclear-propelled ships. There has never been any disagreement that nuclear propulsion is better than fossil fuel propulsion. There has never been any disagreement that nuclear propulsion is more costly. The argument has always been whether the additional effectiveness was worth the additional cost. In the case of submarines, it quite clearly is, because it changes the whole nature of the beast. It can stay submerged to the limit of human endurance. In the case of a few aircraft carriers and the escorts to go with them for rapid movement to new areas, it is also useful. When you go beyond that number, you give up, in the case of surface escorts, 5 fossil-fueled escorts to get 1 nuclear-propelled escort, and it's quite clear that we will lose the war faster for lack of numbers than we will win it for the additional efficiency of the diminishing fleet.
To pursue that a minute, why is that self-evident? Some of our listeners may not be aware of some of the strategic details.
One can visualize the problem quite simply. 5 ships can be in 5 parts of the ocean doing 5 different jobs, whereas 1 ship can only be in 1 place at 1 time. Admiral Rickover is like any advocate who is selling a specific program within a normal range of checks and balance. He had a very effective program. As he became more powerful and unchecked and unreined, his advocacy has led to flawed programs which interfere with the proper balance, and we don't have a balanced Navy.
Rich Semmel.
Admiral, a number of people have stated recently that with large budget cuts in store for the Navy, it will have to face the realization that it simply does not have the capability to defend all U.S. interests across the globe. If that is so, do you think that there is a specific priority list which details which defense areas are most important for the United States?
Well, why don't we just start out by discussing for a minute what would have to happen in war. The very first thing we would have to do is abandon Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, write them off, let them go to the other side, and concentrate on the defense of Hawaii and Alaska in the Pacific. We would have to put most of our ships into the North Atlantic in a desperate effort, probably a losing effort, to try to save Western Europe. We would abandon the Eastern Mediterranean and the entire Mideast. We would try to hang on to the western and northern parts of Africa and abandon the rest of the continent. Now, if the United States Navy must limit its objectives to that range, the real question is that satisfactory for the United States?
Sir, what specifically is Operation Achaean, and what's the significance of Achaean 75?
About every 5 years, the Soviet Navy runs a global fleet exercise. Okeon 70 and Okeon 75 are the two most recent examples. In the 1970 exercise, they demonstrated an ability to strike simultaneously five different U.S. naval task forces around the globe with air, submarine, and surface attacks coordinated within 90 seconds of one another on a global basis. In 1975, they demonstrated an even more remarkable capability to operate on a global basis. This is part of the evaluation that goes into the determination of the odds of victory, and one of the reasons why the Soviet Union looks to be a clear winner.
Alexander Kenyon.
Sir, I was wondering, what is the role of the aircraft carrier in the 1970s?
It is about the only tool that the President of the United States has available to him in a crisis. In crisis after crisis, when a president finds himself in trouble and needs to bring air power to bear to have impact, he finds himself sending floating airfields, the aircraft carrier, to do the job.
A final question for our guest when Focus on Youth continues in a moment.
Here's a question from Shell. What's a safe following distance when you're behind another car? Answer, at least a 2 second interval. Select an object along the roadside ahead. When the car in front of you passes it, start counting 1001, 1002. You should finish 1002 just as you reach the object. If you reach it first, you're following too close. Learn more safe driving tips in the Driving Skills book, free at participating Shell dealers.
Come to Shell for answers.
Well, I was out there in the forest and I really meant no harm. I built me a little campfire just to keep my coffee warm. But I was in a hurry, so I left it burning there. I heard a sound, and when I turned around, there was an angry bear. He said, my name is Smokey, and I used to ask folks nice to stir their campfire with a stick and drown that fire twice. But now it's no more Mr. Nice Bear, 'cause I've had enough of you. Just one last time I'll speak my mind, here's what you better do. Wipe out your campfire, beat out the embers, drown it with water all the way through. Get all the red out, make sure it's dead out, or Smokey the Bear will rake you in two. A public service on behalf of your state foresters, the Forest Service, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Focus on Youth. Our guest is retired Admiral Elmo Zumwalt. A final question now from Mitch Summel.
You served as Chief of Naval Operations from 1970 to 1974 at the height of Richard Nixon's power in office. And I was curious as to, first, your actual input to the president at that time. You had a number of celebrated fights with him regarding naval policies. And second, your impressions of an administrative structure that seemed to put loyalty to the president above loyalty to the country.
Well, I think the major error that Mr. Nixon made, and I think history will probably confirm this, is that he made the mistake of isolating himself. He had only two sources of principal seminal input. One was Kissinger on the foreign policy and defense side, and the other was Haldeman on the domestic side. Every other president has had 10 or 15 or 20 different antenna out picking up signals. Mr. Nixon retreated to his Oval Office and a yellow pad and let Haldeman and Kissinger decide for him what he was going to receive. In my judgment, he couldn't have picked two less capable individuals, and these are the people who are responsible for his downfall.
Admiral Zumwalt, thank you for being today's guest on Focus on Youth.
Good to be with you.
The executive producer and moderator of Focus on Youth is Garth R. Anseer. Focus on Youth is a presentation of the Focus on Youth Radio Network and was recorded and edited for broadcast. This program was made possible by funding from the Shell Oil Company.
The opinions expressed by the guests on Focus on Youth do not necessarily represent the opinions of the Focus on Youth Network, its sponsors, or this station. This is Dwight Holloway for Admiral Elmo Zumwalt and the Focus on Youth staff saying goodbye until next week.